From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how pediatricians are adjusting their vaccination guidance in response to measles outbreaks in Southeast Michigan.
This is one of the most highly contagious viruses, and if you're not vaccinated, you're at risk for getting this disease.
Also, a shortage of psychiatric beds for young people forces families to rely on out-of-state options.
We were at about like 1,200 in 2020, and today we're about 400.
Plus, for National Poetry Month, we revisit a conversation with Zilka Joseph, whose experiences and verse reflect multiple cultures and histories.
In a way, I think we just carry all these worlds within us wherever we go. So it's become quite organic to me to write about the past.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, writer Zilka Joseph. Her poetry tackles human experience across cultural boundaries with a freedom of thought that doesn't shy away from difficult subjects.
Sweet Malida. Sweet Malida, a mix of water softened, flattened rice, sugar, dried fruits, and nuts, was a dish made for Shabbat or for breaking our fasts. Cooling, light on the palate, and to the body and the spirit. It was welcome in the heat of day or night. We had many foods in common with our Muslim, Christian, and Hindu neighbors.
She's got a really unique style and outlook. We'll meet her later this hour. But first, parents of infants are typically advised to wait until certain age markers to give their babies the vaccines against measles, mumps, and rubella. You've probably heard this referred to as the MMR vaccine. In the past, the risk of those diseases has been relatively low, but we've been seeing new outbreaks of measles in parts of the country, including Southeast Michigan. So health leaders are updating their recommendations. Kristen Jordan-Shamus is a health reporter with the Detroit Free Press. We've invited her here to talk about the new recommendations and what we know about the measles cases here in Michigan. Kristen, hi, welcome back.
Hi, April. It's great to talk with you today.
So what are measles cases looking like in Michigan this year?
So we have 8 confirmed cases of measles so far this year. Since March 11th, they've been diagnosed in 2 counties, Washtenaw County and Monroe County. But what's concerning to health officials this year in Michigan is that we have this Monroe County case that isn't associated with any of the cases in Washtenaw County and is not associated with travel out of the state in areas where there are measles infections. So it's sort of this wild case of measles that they cannot identify a source, which makes them concerned that there could be community spread of the virus.
Right. Meaning to say sources have been tracked and there was no contact between the Washtenaw County cases that they can tell and the Monroe case, right?
Exactly. And so that led state health officials to say, if you're the parent of an infant who is 6 months to 11 months old, go ahead and get them that MMR vaccine, that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, to give them some protection, just in case that virus is swirling around in their communities. And that advisory, that recommendation, applies to 7 counties in Michigan.
And those counties, as you reported, would be Washtenaw, Wayne, Monroe, Oakland, Jackson, Livingston, and Lenawee. Kristen, how do this year's measles outbreaks compare with some of our recent years in Michigan?
So we're seeing some pretty big upticks in activity in measles nationally. In Michigan, we have just 8 cases, which doesn't sound like a lot, but as we know, this is one of the most highly contagious viruses that's out there in the world. And if you're not vaccinated, you're at risk for getting this disease. And in our community, we have had lower and lower and lower vaccination rates. I believe the state health department says just 66% of kids between the ages of 4 and 6 have had the recommended 2 doses of the MMR vaccine. And that MMR vaccine is really protective. It'll give you 97% protection from the virus.
Let's talk more about that change on the timeline. What is the age range that doctors are now recommending for MMR vaccines?
6 months to 11 months is what they're recommending, and that is based on the American Academy of Pediatrics and their recommendations in outbreak situations. So ordinarily, the Academy recommends that children get their first dose of the MMR vaccine starting at about 12 months old. The belief is that maybe if the mother had been vaccinated for measles, mumps, and rubella, that the mother's previous vaccination will also confer a little bit of immunity to the infant until they can get their first dose. And the idea is that if you wait until 12 months, the child will then develop a stronger response and immunity to the virus and, or to the vaccine, so that they won't be as susceptible to the virus. And by having your child immunized early, there aren't really any risks to the child, but what it does do is mean that they will still need two doses before the age of six, after that initial accelerated early dose, to ensure that they do develop lasting immunity.
Got it. Are you hearing from health officials whether there are particular communities in Michigan that are more at risk? I mean, I guess I'm thinking about those that are geographically close to the outbreaks we know of, right?
Exactly. So the two counties that are at highest risk right now are Washtenaw and Monroe, because those are the two counties with known and confirmed cases. But health officials are saying that people who live in Wayne County, Oakland County, Jackson County, Livingston, and Lenawee counties ought to also consider accelerating the vaccination of their children ages 6 to 11 months old. In addition, even if you don't live in those neighboring counties, but you've visited Washtenaw or Monroe, they're saying go ahead and get that vaccine for your children. They're also saying that if you don't have, as an adult or an older child, if there's no evidence of immunity, you should reach out to your healthcare provider and see whether you're eligible for a vaccine now. So for example, if you were born and were vaccinated prior to 1989, there is a chance that you only got one dose of the MMR vaccine. Back then, the CDC recommended only one dose because they thought that that would give you long-lasting immunity. But since then, the recommendations have changed, and now they're saying all people should have two doses of the vaccine in order to ensure full protection. So if you might have had only one dose and you might get a breakthrough infection, for example, in an outbreak situation. So it's always a good idea to have that conversation with a healthcare provider to make sure that you're protected.
I go to a doctor's office in Washtenaw County, and this came up in a recent visit for me, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Kristen, one thing I've always wondered, does measles have a season the way that flu does and that we sometimes go through with COVID in the winter and spring months?
That's a good question. You know, we have measles transmission, though, that happens all calendar year. But a lot of times we do start to see an uptick in the spring, and I don't really know why that is. But the virus is transmissible no matter what the season is.
I mean, I guess spring is a time when school kids are traveling, so it might have something to do with it.
It is spring break season, right? And so a lot of people in this region are going to warmer places for spring break, and a lot of those places have outbreaks of measles. Florida, South Carolina, lots of parts of the country. And then internationally, too, there are outbreaks of measles. And so you can bring those back home with you without even realizing that you have the virus. The other thing that's interesting that I learned this week is that people who have measles infections, they can transmit the virus and be infectious with the virus before they have any symptoms. And so you might be carrying the virus before you develop that telltale rash, and you may have exposed other people before you even knew you had measles.
This is a subject, vaccination rates are something that we've talked about with you before, but do you have a bead on how concerned state health officials are about the falling rate of vaccination, especially among school-aged kids?
They're extremely concerned, and they're trying to get the word out as best they can to folks about just how important it is to protect their kids and even adults from vaccine-preventable diseases. It isn't just measles. It's you know, the flu, for example, which kills children every single year. It is COVID-19, which is still out there and is still affecting people and taking lives. There are so many vaccines that are available that do so much great work in the community. And health officials just really are hoping that folks will start to recognize that and get back on the schedule and get caught up with all the vaccines that they're missing.
Can you tell us anything about the availability of MMR vaccines? Like I said, I was offered one at a doctor's appointment as an adult. But have you heard anything that would suggest that people are having trouble getting it if they want it?
It's really easy to get a vaccine. You can get it at a pharmacy if you ask. Health department offices have them. A lot of times your primary care physician's office might have them. If you live in Washtenaw County, for example, where we know we have an outbreak, you can call 734-544-6700 to schedule a vaccine appointment at the health department. And in Monroe County, the number to call is 734-240-7830 to schedule a vaccine appointment.
Are there any other groups of people who might be vulnerable to measles in the midst of an outbreak?
The only other thing that I think is worth considering and thinking about is that in addition to those people who were born, you know, before 1989 and were vaccinated at that time, there are some also, there's another vulnerable category of folks. And those are people who were vaccinated before 1968. There was a brief period of time when there was a less effective version of the vaccine that was given. And so those folks might also need to check and make sure that they don't need another dose.
Kristen Jordan-Shamus is a health and health policy reporter at the Detroit Free Press. And you can read her recent coverage about measles outbreaks at freep.com. Kristen, thank you so much for this.
Thanks a lot, April. Have a great day.
It's time for a break. After that, what happens when young people in Michigan look for care during a mental health crisis and struggle to find it?
This was a family that ended up paying about $90,000 to help their daughter get the mental health that they needed out of state. That very clearly can be a financial barrier to access for some families. I mean, heck, even with the Midlands, they talked to us about the fact that that was a very steep, hard debt for their family to handle.
That's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past decade, Michigan has nearly doubled the number of young people who've been placed in out-of-state mental health facilities. Generally, we're talking about long-term facilities where kids and teenagers can receive a more intensive form of care. Providers across the state have been scrambling to increase capacity since the COVID-19 pandemic. Just last month, Pine Rest opened a new inpatient unit with 68 beds for youth. But amidst policy shifts and a number of facility closures, in-state capacity has actually gone down. Bridge Michigan reporters Eli Newman and Jordan Hermony have spent the past several weeks speaking with families and analyzing the impact. We've invited them here today to talk about what they found. Eli, Jordan, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Can I just ask, maybe one of you could start by explaining, when a young person is sent out of state, what does that actually look like for the young people themselves and the families day to day? Eli, do you want to maybe start us out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could start in a lot of different ways, right? What actually precipitates somebody leaving the state could be something like a court order, right, where they're going through the youth justice system and they're actually being forced to kind of find one of these facilities, or it's a family taking upon themselves to make that decision for the benefit of their child, which is what we profiled with the Midland family. And what happened in that situation was, you know, they found a facility somewhere outside of Kansas City in Missouri. And so that's an 11-hour drive away. And at the time of Eleanor's admission, who is 15 at the time, you know, she was not necessarily in a position where she wanted to go to one of these facilities. It was, you know, she was almost taken there against her will. So it's not like you can very easily get onto like a flight, and it's all, everything's copacetic. You know, I think there's a lot of wrangling that her family had to do to make sure that they could actually get her in the car. And then they all took turns driving that 11-hour drive to make sure that she could be admitted safely. But of course, there's a lot of other ways that kids get transported to some of these facilities. Sometimes there's people that show up at their door and from that facility, and they do this kind of transport, which is something that you may have heard Paris Hilton speak about. So there's like a lot of different ways that people find themselves actually entering these facilities. And it's typically at that point of where they're experiencing like peak mental health crisis.
And I don't know who needs to hear this, but whatever way it happens, even people who haven't read your article may have gotten the drift. Like these tend to be families in crisis, right?
Yeah, no, 100%.
And that exactly kind of gets to the point. This is a very convoluted, complex, and complicated type of system just from the jump. And then you factor in the fact that there are, as you point out, you know, these are children in crisis. This is somebody's baby. And, you know, there is not always like a one size fits all way for people to interface with the system, which can lead to some very serious hardships. You know, we talked to two different families where one, they had to sort of voluntarily figure out this system on their own. When we talk about Eleanor Midland, this was a family that ended up paying about $90,000 to help their daughter get the mental health that they needed out of state. That very clearly can be a financial barrier to access for some families. I mean, heck, even with the Midlands, they talked to us about the fact that was a very steep, hard debt for their family to handle. And then, you know, we've talked to families where their children were, like Eli mentioned, court ordered. They had no real say in where their child was sent. In that place, it was so far out west. And to that, the parent basically told us it was like throwing their child to the wolves and hoping that something would be better than nothing at all. And I think that's mostly the point of why we wanted to write this article, is just really showcasing what a deeply complex system that this is, how it impacts Michigan families, and the fact of the matter being that there is no real one-size-fits-all answer or solution for how to improve this system, especially not overnight.
How many facilities have we lost over the past couple of years? Eli, what's the overview look like on that?
Yeah, I mean, the estimates that we got from people who are pretty involved in the field is something about, you know, 16 facilities. Now, I think it should also be noted that not every facility has the same amount of capacity. Some of these facilities that are closing actually have really huge capacity. What we've seen in terms of like the overall like bed supply, and so this is, you know, a way that the state monitors the amount of beds that are available for youth to be placed in, we were at somewhere about like 1,200 around the beginning of the pandemic in 2020. And today we're about 400. So we've seen like a pretty significant drop off in those years. And I think there's something about 100 child caring facilities that are still operating in Michigan today.
Is there a set of reasons that kept coming up about why facilities did close? I mean, is this a question of reimbursement either from federal programs like Medicaid or private health insurance?
What we've been hearing was that there was a series of potential reasons. One instance that was brought up pretty frequently from the providers themselves was that they felt certain state regulations instituted during COVID regarding seclusion and restraint, that somewhat hand-tied their ability to work with children, that because they weren't allowed to secure or restrain children who potentially might be going through a physical component of a mental health episode, that would in turn then result in, for instance, like damages to the facility itself, damages potentially to other kids. Now, I will interject and say that the state said that as recently as February, there were over 300 instances of facility staff at these facilities being able to use restraint in some way, shape, or form against children at these facilities itself. So the state will say that they still have the ability to work within these regulations, but providers were basically telling us that these regulations have made it pretty difficult for them to operate, that there were instances of, for instance, Vista Maria, perhaps one of the more famed facilities to have closed in recent months. They ceased operate, the facility itself still operates, but their program to deal with or to help troubled girls, that closed in December. And we were told by the CEO there that they were actually informed ahead of that closure that their workman's comp would no longer be covering them because the staff at that facility had suffered such severe injuries, including broken kneecaps, dislocated shoulders, things of that nature. So they were arguing that they can't keep their staff safe, that there are children with higher acuity of needs being sent to facilities that cannot handle. Again, as Eli points out, not every facility is equipped to handle every level of mental health need. You can have from the, and I don't want to sound disparaging of any mental health crises in particular, but there are some needs that are greater than others. Not all facilities are equipped equally. And so, you know, operators, they're saying that they're getting more boys and girls who they just can't simply care for. So that was a huge part of what we were hearing out of the facility operator side. And that between that and insurance not covering certain stays, I know that that was something that was brought up with the Midland saying that that $90,000 figure, that's what they had to pay even with having some level of insurance. And it's just it's kind of a minefield, frankly, of issues that people seem to be running into on all sides of the aisle here. And nobody really seeming to have a clear cut answer on how to navigate that.
Just even backing out a little bit, outside of that regulatory reform that happened with restraint and seclusion, I think providers had also really described a really charged environment where, in terms of the broader society and culturally, in terms of just youth mental health issues just being generally on the rise over the last decade or so. A lot of them do point to like social media being a major component to that dynamic and to this rise of cases. But I think I'd be remiss not to mention the effects of the pandemic and how that really accelerated a lot of these issues, how you know, a lot of the mental health crises really did rise exponentially because of people living online, being isolated from normal kind of social circumstances. And that also had a significant effect on staffing and people wanting to work in these places where there was a period of time where it was, you know, basically under lockdown or some sort of quarantine. And this is something that I think we've seen across the entire healthcare sector, but definitely something that I think influenced a lot of these issues that I think we're now seeing the ramifications of today.
Eli, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't get into some of the subtleties. Can you tell us a little bit more about Eleanor's situation? You know, how she got into a residential, I mean, she refers to it as a boarding school.
Yeah.
And what happened as a result of that stay?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that with Eleanor, although she was admitted to this boarding school in Kansas City when she was 15, she had multi-year struggle with various mental health issues. Her family, she and her family describes a lot of this happening when she was 12 years, you know, as young as 12 years old, with suicidal ideation and self-harm. And that resulted, and even I think kind of leading up to that, which I think is a real crisis moment in this family's mind, she was still seeing therapists up until that point. You know, I think that there was this kind of, you know, support system in terms of like medical interventions that were happening up until this point. But at 12 years old, she was admitted to like a short-term psychiatric facility near where she lives in Holt, and was able to get, again, short-term care. She was there for a couple weeks, and that helped stabilize her from this crisis. But she had some, you know, deep-seated mental health issues that, again, that were exacerbated, I mean, throughout the years and over the course of the pandemic. So, you know, the suicidal ideation and the depression manifested also with substance use disorder, also manifested in eating disorders. So there was a lot of various issues that were manifesting at the same time, which is, you know, I think was very challenging for her family to deal with. So yes, she was seeing a therapist. Yes, she was seeking medication to help deal with some of these issues, but they didn't really feel that it was enough to give her that that long-term care that she needed. And so the big struggle of her family is that they were looking for a program specifically that focused on longevity. Where could we place Eleanor for a long period of time where she could really work out these issues? And eventually they did find it in Kansas City. But again, I think there was even a lot of issues with her time at that facility. A lot of these programs have a sordid history we've seen it with Vista Maria and some of the allegations that are coming out there in terms of the abuse that people face at these facilities. So I think it's a very challenging landscape to navigate in terms of where do we find that right kind of care for our particular situation that addresses all these very specific needs, but also how can we make sure that this program isn't going to have all sorts of really this toxic culture behind it.
Yeah. I mean, my takeaway from the whole of it is that it's not that there isn't a place for residential treatment. It's not that these families are not in a dire enough situation that they wouldn't, you know, that they wouldn't consider it, but that the whole option of having to go out of state is just such a huge problem.
Well, and that's when we were talking with lawmakers, that was one of the big things that they brought up as well, was that, you know, who is ultimately responsible? Should a Michigan child get hurt in an out-of-state facility? And I want to back up a little bit too and say that, you know, Eleanor Midland's story, while a part of what we are talking about, children being sent out of state for mental health treatment, the data that we have, the data that we're reporting, is also just a fraction of the overall picture. As of last September, 152 youth were placed out of state. That's what we were able to find through state documents. Now, the state has told us that they believe that the rise in out-of-state placements is largely limited to court-supervised youth, of which Eleanor, one of our main sources here, would not count. So her story is not reflected at all in this data, meaning that we could be faced with a much larger reality than what we're able to tangibly report.
Right. One last question. It's clear this is a pretty costly solution for the state. More than $13 million spent on out-of-state facilities with, I think, Eli, the state, covering roughly half that total. I mean, would you say that's a significant cost in lawmakers' minds?
I think any kind of cost like that that is being spent outside of Michigan, I think, is a lot. Especially when you look at where things were 10 years before that, where I believe that number in terms of money that was going to facilities was about $1.5 million. So we've seen a really significant increase over the last 10 years. So I think, yes, there's inflationary pressures and all sorts of things that help contribute to that rise in cost. But I think it's just a general concern for lawmakers, for families, for providers, to see people have to go out of state, to have to deal with the difficulty of yes, their child may have found a place that is helpful for them, but now they have to deal with this distance and the logistics of navigating that distance for visitation, and just to make sure that they're being, you know, that they're being taken care of and that the program is actually doing the things that it's purporting to be doing. I would say generally speaking, I think lawmakers have expressed a frustration that we've seen really diminishing returns over time in terms of what we're able to provide for our kids in state. And, you know, I think by all accounts, these mental health issues aren't going away. And so the question becomes what are we going to do to fix it? And, you know, I think time will tell in terms of what that plan looks like. We hear a little bit of, you know, reform packages here and there, but I think people are looking for a little bit bigger than a Band-Aid for this issue. I think they're looking for a more comprehensive reform that might safeguard a lot of Michigan's youth, you know, that are in these really extreme crises.
Eli Newman and Jordan Hermony of Bridge, Michigan. Eli, Jordan, thank you both so much for this.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We've had some heavy rain lately, but I think the sun is finally starting to poke through the clouds. Writer Tamar Charney offers us this spring meditation on leaning into nature as a source of healing.
One evening after a day of rain, I walked to the woods near my house. I was in a bad mood, and I thought maybe going for a walk would help. It was spring, so I wasn't surprised to hear some frogs as I stepped off the pavement and onto the trail. But as I walked down the first hill to a low point in the woods, the sound suddenly engulfed me and was loud. It was a chorus of gray tree frogs. None of their voices were quite the same, but they were all singing the same basic song. Some were right in front of me, some on each side, and others arrayed in the distance. Their trills echoed through the woods. These singing frogs are little guys, and they are guys, less than 2 inches in size. The males sing to attract mates. But they weren't in the pond in the swamp like the spring peepers and chorus frogs. They were everywhere in the woods, and that's what made this frog concert seem different. I wasn't the only one to appreciate it. Another person walking in the woods stopped at the bottom of the hill as well to listen and savor the performance. The male frog chorus is there trying to attract lady frogs. But in the process, they also attracted two female humans who also appreciated their charms. After a while, I recorded a short snippet on my phone in order to remember the encounter, and I continued on my way. The sound receded in the distance as I left the woods, and that's when I realized my bad mood was gone.
If you're seeing notable things on your spring walks, please do drop us a line and tell us about them. Our email address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. We need to take a break now. After that, poet Zilka Joseph talks to us about the community that she grew up in, a unique Jewish enclave in Mumbai. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. About 2,000 years ago, Jewish families came to India, forming a community that became known as the Bene Israel. If you're up for it, the theories around its founding are pretty fascinating. Were these people running from Roman persecution? Or were they possibly one of the lost tribes of Israel? A girl born into that community grew up to be the Michigan poet Zilka Joseph.
Juicy threads of coconut with a fleck of stubborn brown kernel here and there that sometimes crunched in your teeth like sand. And you winced and you swallowed it, knowing that there was no simpler or purer or truer form than that.
Since publishing her first collection of poetry during the pandemic, Zilka, who lives in Ann Arbor, has continued to explore what it means to be an immigrant from India, building a life in the United States, told through the lens of her Indian Jewish heritage. We spoke to her in 2024. Here's our conversation.
Hi, April. I'm just so delighted to be here with you on this absolutely wonderful program.
Oh my gosh, thank you. It's not even our birthday. Thank you. Zilka, there's plenty to talk about in terms of your cultural influences, and we will do that. But I wondered if I could start by asking you to read for us from the collection. Could we start with the title poem, Sweet Melita?
Absolutely. So just a quick note before I read it. Malida is the name of the dish, which is made from this flattened and parched rice. But it's also a very important ceremony that is held for Prophet Elijah. So in that case, it's called the Malida ceremony. But here in this poem, I'm just talking about the dish itself and the memories involved with it. Sweet Malida. Sweet Malida, a mix of water softened, flattened rice, sugar, dried fruits, and nuts, was a dish made for Shabbat or for breaking our fasts. Cooling, light on the palate and to the body and the spirit, it was welcome in the heat of day and night. We had many foods in common with our Muslim, Christian, and Hindu neighbors, and we often celebrated together their festivals or ours. I relished particularly fresh coconut, the regional staple, its milk or its flesh added to almost every dish. But this was to me the best way to eat it, finely grated by my mother's hands. left unsweetened and sprinkled haphazardly on the malida. Juicy threads of coconut with a fleck of stubborn brown kernel here and there that sometimes crunched in your teeth like sand. And you winced and you swallowed it, knowing that there was no simpler or purer or truer form than that.
Not every great poem has this quality, but that one does something that a lot of great poems do. It gives us, it opens up three or four different important things at once. I mean, the memories of your mom, memories of food, memories of community all in the same time. Was that a poem that you wrote relatively recently?
It's actually a poem that I had written a while ago, but it kind of came to the fore when I submitted it to an anthology. It was a wonderful collection, anthology of Jewish poems, so poems about Jewish subject matter. So that's how it sort of was brought to life for the first time.
Had you always written about your childhood and these kinds of sense memories and a community that, you know, it still exists, but it's smaller than it was? I wondered if maybe memory has become a more important subject to you the farther away from Mumbai you've moved.
I think really that becomes true of anybody who travels or who immigrates to a different country or moves from city to city, you know. I think we just carry all these worlds within us wherever we go. So it's become quite organic to me to write about the past, because that doesn't seem that far removed for me in some ways. And it sort of plays in and out with my present life. I don't know if I'm making sense, but one thing definitely is loss plays a huge role in my writing. And perhaps this is also my way to reclaim the past, to reclaim loss and people who I have lost. But at the same time, it's how the past and present sort of exists really in the same continuum for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really sure I completely understand that, but it's something I don't analyze. And the same thing happens in writing, because you're not just writing about one thing. There are all these different levels of what's conscious and subconscious and hidden, that sort of speaks in these different layers.
Right.
That happens in the process of writing. It's only much later when I come back to the work and I think, okay, what is this writing saying? What can I do with it? Then I bring in craft, and that's a whole different subject altogether.
Well, speaking of, many of your poems end on either a dramatic note or at least a cinematic note. I think we can say that that's true of that one you just read, Sweet Malida. Can you tell me how you think through, the closing meters and what something that's memorable, but that also might have something like finality to it?
Yes, of course, as a poet, we focus so much on words and the effects and the sounds and the sonic effect. So it's very important to me that each word is the right word in that particular line. And a lot of what's also important is the line breaks. So you have to focus very clearly on what word you want to end, what word you want the next sentence to begin with, where the stanza breaks are, because the eye has to travel in a way just like when you're watching a movie and the scenes are changing. So it does, each word has a resonance, each word has association, each word or image takes you somewhere. And I think that links with what you say about how poems are also cinematic. I lead the reader from line to line, word to word, image to image. And some of my poems, which have more prose or more prosaic, they have the more the storytelling quality. But then the words are still very important, and the choice of words and how poetic they are, or how dramatic that moment is. It's very carefully chosen. And a lot of work and editing and rewriting goes into this whole process.
Can we have you read another poem? There's one called Not One Fish that I'm very curious about.
Okay. Yes. So this kind of goes back to a legend about somebody called David Rahabi, who visited this community. So the Ben Israel community were not discovered till much later in time. And once they were discovered, then the Jews of Cochin got to hear about them. And the Jews of Cochin had a rabbi, they had they were scholars, they were practicing rigorously their, the Judaic laws. And so David Rahabi from Cochin decided that he would visit these people to see who they were, because nobody really knew about this community, but they were practicing the Jewish faith. So that's what it's about. And it says, not one fish. David Rahabi, a central figure in many stories, including one saying that he came in 1,000 years CE, he may actually have been David Ezekiel Rahabi, 1694-1772, from Cochin on the Malabar coast, who helped revive Judaism among the Ben Israel. So David Rahabi of Malabar traveled north up the west coast and encountered the Shanwar Thelis, who had taken the names of the villages for their own. He wondered at the oil pressers and farmers, others who made a living by other rural professions, these women and men who had lived as a caste among the locals. So long unknown, this mysterious community, so apart from the urban world. They did not call themselves Jews, nor did they know the word. But he was impressed by the ancient rituals they practiced, the powerful prayer they remembered and used for all occasions, the Shema Israel, which had kept them together. As legend goes, he asked the women to prepare a feast for him from the bounty of the Arabian Sea. Would they pick crab and shrimp, mussel, clam, or bottom feeders? No, not one fish. Not one fish without fins and scales had they chosen. Not one fish without fins or scales was served. They brought him white-fleshed fish like poplet, and the oily fish like bhangra and tarli, and fresh and flavorful and salty from the waters that brought the Ben Israel hence from the land of Solomon and David. He knew then they kept kosher, a word they did not recall, just kept a simple faith in the God of Abraham.
Zilka Joseph, I'd read accounts of the Ben Israel that, you know, suggest, oh, they became assimilated, they don't really follow Jewish tradition, they're more culturally Southeast Asian. But obviously, with that poem and other works, you definitely push back on that. First,
can I just jump in a little bit here?
Please.
But we do have our customs, our clothing, our food is very Indian. So we adapted completely to Indian life.
Right.
But we kept the faith in these small ways till we were discovered and then were taught Judaic laws again. So that's what's so interesting about this community, that even though they existed among the Hindu villagers, they kept a handful of their tenets and laws, and that's how they were discovered, and they came to the conclusion that these were ancient Jews. Otherwise, how would they have followed these principles
right.
and laws? So that's what's interesting. We are called Indian Jews because We wear Indian clothing. We have Indian food, you know. So we are probably the most Indian of the Jews that exist in India today.
What was the faith tradition like when you were growing up? How had that mix manifested?
For us, for me personally, we grew up in a very liberal family. We were not religious. Well, of course, we knew of our customs. We had friends who were Jewish. And we celebrated certain festivals. And we had, you know, we'd go over to our friend's place to enjoy their feasts. But because I lived in Calcutta, or Kolkata as we call it today, we had friends who were Baghdadi Jews. And we enjoyed their food and gatherings with them.
Right.
But most of my community are in Mumbai. There are some in Delhi, but mostly in Calcutta, we had the Baghdadi Jewish community, which was a community that came to India with the trade routes in 17th and 18th century. So it's quite a complex history. We have three ancient communities and two newly discovered communities. So there are five current communities of Jews in India.
Have you found yourself more or less drawn to the spiritual tradition over the years?
I think in a way I always have been drawn to the spiritual, and perhaps without really thinking about it so much, I've always been interested in not just the spirit and who we are and where we come from and all of that, but so much of it is, I'm very interested in mysticism as well. So I love stories that connect us with like something unknown, something unexplained. And that's why even the stories of Elijah are so fascinating. So for me, it's not a religious journey so much as it is a journey in ancient story and myth-making and how that connects also with my sort of exploration and seeking in life.
Keeping in mind how far flung the Ben Israel have settled, I believe there are only a couple of thousand folks left in the community in India today, while there are many more throughout the world.
That is correct. I think roughly, and again, you know, these figures do change, there are probably about 5,000 left in India in that community, mm-hmm. give or take 500 here and there. But I think in the world, if I may refer to the notes at the back of my book, probably much more if you look at the statistics of the numbers in the world. But also people have intermarried a lot, and we have families like, I think, in everywhere.
Right. What does the Jewish tradition then, what does that mean to you today? Is it still a part of your life?
It is definitely something that makes me who I am, in that I feel connected with certain traditions and stories. But again, it's not so much deeply religious as it is a spiritual connection. And a spiritual connection I feel I have with my ancestors, mm-hmm. and perhaps my grandparents and my parents who have passed on. So I think that's what sort of made me so aware of the tradition I come from. And then as I began writing a few poems about food and some of their histories, then I realized that this could be a very meaningful collection for me, where I could share with the world, you know, the history of this community, as well as the facts that this is real. This is not just some faraway story. If we exist in America, in the UK, and everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wanted that aspect of the beauty of our community to be known.
Zilka, thank you so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I'm so grateful.
That's it for Stateside for today. Our producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansag, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and April Van Buren. The senior producer of Stateside is Mercedes Mejia, and our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Molly Anderson, Astrid Code, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. You can learn more and catch up on recent stories at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.